Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Damage Report. This is John Adirola. We've got so much that we're going to get to through the course of this hour. In just a little bit, two stories coming out of a casual viewing of Fox News, where in both cases they come so close, right up to the precipice of actually learning something fairly fundamental about American politics and how our economy functions. But in both cases, they fall short. So we'll be breaking both of those down. A little bit later on the show, actually, we're going to be closing out the show with an edition of Meanwhile In, giving you news updates on some tragedies in, the air. That's a pretty broad one. In Africa as well. Also updates on news developments in the moon and New Zealand. That's how we're going to close out the show, because there's very exciting, very positive news coming out of New Zealand this week. Along the way, we've got three guests this episode. In just a little bit, actually, in the next block, Marianne Williamson is going to be joining us. She is a contender for the Democratic nomination this time around. She's been called the spiritual sort of advisor to Oprah. Very exciting platform. We're going to be talking about a number of different issues. A little bit later on, Ken Klippenstein has gotten access to some private Twitter groups that Nancy Pelosi's staff maintains, and they found out some more about her positions on impeachment. So Ken Klippenstein is going to be joining us to break that down. And how might the Green New Deal help fight America's opioid epidemic? It's an issue you generally think those two things would be combined, but there is actually a link there, and a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer is going to be joining us to break that down. But we start off with Fox News. Tucker Carlson is, for some reason I can't understand, getting a lot of credit for questioning American capitalism and questioning the ruling class. And look, I've had people on for Media Matters. We've broken down how that's a gigantic hoax. But it becomes even more clear how shallow his newfound criticisms of American capitalism are when you listen to him talk about capitalism on his show. So I want to show you a little bit of his show. And he's on with Jonathan Harris, who's actually been on TYT. Jonathan Harris lays out some of the sort of baked-in issues with American capitalism, and Tucker Carlson comes so close to understanding what's really going on. Let's take a look.
If I'm an employer, would I rather hire you, who's a college-educated American, and pay you enough to live?
Right.
Would I rather hire someone who's used to making $3 a day and then just encourage him to go on food stamps and get housing vouchers, which is what we do?
Well, again, that's capitalism in this country. They do that with Walmart, does that with their workers. All companies do that with their workers.
Really?
They pay them the bare minimum, and then we get stuff.
Why is it capitalism to offload my labor costs onto U.S. taxpayers without telling them?
That's
not capitalism. That's a criminal scam.
That's the way that our system works.
But that's not capitalism.
But how many companies pay workers? Amazon, McDonald's, all these companies that pay their workers far less, and then they have to go get government assistance, and we pay for it.
I'm very aware.
That's not just something that happens with illegal immigrants.
So I guess it's not just illegal immigrants.
Right.
You're absolutely right. They make it much worse, though, by flooding the labor market at the lower end, and they lower the price of labor, because businesses can do this because people will work for less. My question, though, this is all supply and demand, Econ 101.
By the way, really fast. So I disagree with Jonathan Harris on some things having to do with, like who should win the Democratic primary and stuff like that. But sometimes, I mean, look, he's a good guy, and sometimes he's just, the face he makes at Tucker is how America looks at Tucker's show. It's, what are you talking about? And so, look, the main thing that I want to focus on is Tucker's assertion that what he's describing, so he understands the issue, apparently. Most Republicans won't acknowledge this. He at least will acknowledge that many of the biggest, most profitable corporations in the history of our planet have gotten that way in recent years by offloading costs that should be theirs onto American taxpayers. So we talk about that in the case of Walmart a lot, but it's true of Amazon, it's true of a number of other corporations, where they pay them just enough that they don't starve to death, thanks to the American taxpayer subsidizing their life in a number of different ways, so that we don't have people dying across the country. Tucker Carlson seems to acknowledge that that's going on, but he says that that's not actually an indictment of capitalism. It's not actually an indictment of American capitalism in particular. It's a criminal scam. But here's the thing, Ding Dong. It's not criminal whatsoever. It is 100% legal to do this. And this is only the most obvious, most transparent way that they do this. There are others. There are externalities where there are costs that there's every reason that, for instance, fossil fuel companies should be paying for the fact that, as we're going to be talking about later on the show, they are killing literally millions of people around the globe every year thanks to respiratory illnesses that are a baked-in cost to the product that they sell. But they don't pay for that. ExxonMobil doesn't pay for someone's medical care, you know, on the other side of the globe. But somebody pays for it. And in some cases, in our country, it's our taxpayers. In some cases, it's Chinese taxpayers or taxpayers in Mozambique or wherever. They are paying for those companies to make slightly higher profits. And in none of these cases, at least right now, is this even remotely illegal. Certainly unethical once you get people to actually think about it, but it's not illegal at all. That's how it works. And it's not some weird random ripple effect or development. This is a product of lobbying for decades. They have bought politicians to pass laws to make it so that this system can maintain itself the way it is right now. And for Tucker Carlson, a guy who, first of all, works for a massive corporation, himself is the benefactor of generational wealth on an order of magnitude beyond anything I can even imagine. For him to pretend that he doesn't get this is certainly beneficial to him in trying to maintain his position as this sort of faux populist, sure, but it is laughable. For him to say that, oh no, that doesn't really say anything about capitalism whatsoever. We don't need any actual structural changes to capitalism. That's just this thing, this criminal scam, which is not just ignorant, but by itself should be the death knell for the idea that he is an actual serious critic of American capitalism. Because what does he retreat to there? When a very obvious, solvable problem is identified, he retreats to don't do anything about American capitalism. So he wants to pretend that he's the guy that recognizes what the elites are doing in media and in politics and in the economy and all of that. But at the end of the day, he is still there to maintain the status quo. That is the shell game that he's playing with the American public and with his viewers in particular. At the end of the day, the funny thing is, it's not like he's screwing over leftists. He's not screwing over progressives. They're not watching his show anyway. The only reason I see any of it is because of the good people at Media Matters. He's screwing over conservatives by trying to redirect them from a much-needed, long-awaited reanalysis of American capitalism, of the interaction between American capitalists and American politicians, and trying to get them to instead just tread water. Don't actually do anything. Okay, maybe you finally acknowledge that there are problems, but don't actually question any of it. Don't actually push for anything. Whereas off on the other side, as they're being distracted by Tucker Carlson, there are people like Bernie Sanders and other progressive politicians who are actually trying to fix these problems, not just pretend that they acknowledge them while benefiting massively economically to not do anything about it. So great job there by Jonathan Harris and Tucker Carlson, a joke as always. Let's move on to something else. Again, Fox almost getting it. Fox News is, as many people have pointed out, AOC TMZ, and they found a new way to attack her. So there's been a lot. She's too poor to understand the American economy. She's secretly too rich to actually represent the working class. She dances too much. Now they've moved to, she's not actually a politician, she's just an actress. Here they go.
You know, it's amazing how big a deal she has become to be a 29-year-old with no major accomplishments to her credit other than making some really bizarre policy pronouncements about the new Green Deal and getting rid of the Amazon jobs in New York. She's making quite a name for herself, and I hope that she continues to be the face of the Democratic Party. It's the best thing that Donald Trump and the Republicans have going for them in 2020.
Right. Somebody's writing her questions. I saw the questions at Michael Cohen and saw the questions at Wilbur Ross. And there are some forces behind her. I think there's a story there.
Well, there very well could be. I know there has been some allegations that she was almost like the Manchurian candidate, recruited, prepared. I don't know. But the point is that she got her voters out.
Okay, so there's a lot of issues there. First of all, I'll just say they acknowledge that she's making a name for herself. And because Fox has had a big issue with her name, I will just clarify, as she has done on Twitter, that it is Ocasio-Cortez. It's not Cortez. You don't get to decide that you're just going to say half of her name. It's not half of her name. And also, she gets to pronounce it the way that she wants. You don't get to put a bunch of white people in suits and tell her how she's supposed to pronounce her name. So now that we've moved past that, they think there's a story there, that she might be a Manchurian candidate. Well, what does that mean? What what that means is that we have another demonstration of how fast the flow of information from the conspiratorial right-wing online types, generally on things like 4chan, but sometimes they have channels on YouTube as well. They come up with BS, and in record time now, it gets to Fox News. It used to be that it had to go through a cycle of perhaps Breitbart or the Drudge Report. Some people would tweet about it, and eventually it'd work its way to Tucker Carlson. But now, they're just watching conspiracy theories being relayed on YouTube, and that's Fox and Friends the next day. And we know, by the way, that then will get to the president faster than a daily intelligence briefing. So if you are a right-winger on YouTube, just make up whatever crazy stuff you want, and the president will be hearing about it and believing it the next day. So here's the thing. They believe that AOC is not a genuine, intelligent person because, of course, how could she be? She's young. They can't be smart. She's a woman. God knows Fox News doesn't believe there could be any real intelligence there. And to top it all off, she's a Latina. So how could she possibly be an actual, intelligent, adaptable, well-researched, ready-for-prime-time politician who accurately reflects the values of millions and millions of Americans? It can't be. There has to be some other explanation. And they believe that they've found it. She's not a real person. She's not a real politician. She is just an actor who has been chosen to fill this role. And they go on to say, as she was asking questions of Michael Cohen, somebody must be writing those questions for her. Somebody's behind her. And she has acknowledged online that that's actually true. They've actually landed on something there. There is someone behind her. It is her staff. Her intelligent, incredibly, well-researched staff that she has chosen, who is making it so that when she goes into these meetings, she asks substantive questions that raise important issues that can later be looked into by the committees that she serves on. She doesn't just go there and grandstand for 5 minutes and waste our time like other politicians who don't get questioned on a daily basis by Fox and Friends. And here's the thing. What they're doing there is saying, we should look at who is behind these politicians. And they're right. They just won't do it with anyone other than AOC. They should be looking at who is behind these politicians. So for other politicians who don't have a team like AOC, who's giving them their questions? Are they're just thinking about on their own? Maybe in some cases, but in a lot of cases, it's lobbyists. It's their donors. That's who's behind them. But Fox and Friends is not set up to question those sorts of backing. Just when it's, oh God, she's raising really important issues and people are starting to question things like taxation and tax fraud and all that, then we need to question her. And by the way, spare me with the, she's an actress. You supported Donald Trump. You love Ronald Reagan. You love actors when they're on your side. She's never actually done any acting. She danced in a video once. That's the extent of it. No, she's a young politician. She is obviously the future of America. That is what scares them so much and leads them to help amplify right-wing conspiracy theories on the mainstream media. Okay, with that, we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we're lucky enough to be joined by presidential candidate Marianne Williamson, is going to be joining us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I am very excited to welcome our next guest to the Damage Report, a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency in 2020, author, activist, and spiritual advisor, Marianne Williamson. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for talking with us today. So, look, I've read a lot about your past. You've been an activist on a number of different issues. You've written many books, and you've also been a political candidate. So this time around, why the presidency? Why are you pursuing the Democratic nomination?
I think we have to have a very real conversation about what's going on in this country. And by real, I mean more fiercely honest and authentic and true about the deeper dynamics of corporatism, of racial inequality, of the way we're neglecting millions of children, of the way that we prepare for war at the expense of waging peace. All of these things are actually a peril to our democracy. And if all we do is present as an option a better version of same old, same old, number one, I don't think that that will defeat the president. And secondly, even if it were to defeat the president, it wouldn't stave off the huge opponents, oppositional forces to real democratic values that will be back big time in 22 and 24. We need to present, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, continue.
Well, we need to present the American people with a genuine option to corporatism. And a kind of establishment left is not a genuine opposition to corporatism. We need to actually have a deeper conversation about what is wrong. You can't just fix things. You have to transform things. America has to take a deep look at our own character defects. America has to take a deep look. The American people has to take a deep look at where we have swerved from our democratic values, where our government is in an unholy alliance with an economic system that put stockholder values before advocacy, not only for our democracy, but for our people, for the people of the world, and for the planet itself. And just kind of sort of fixing things and incremental approaches, and you change an issue here or you change on issue there, is simply watering the leaves. It's not watering the roots. And it's too late for that. So I want to present the American people with an option to actually be an antidote to all the things that have gone wrong by doing things profoundly right. We can't just ignore that millions of American children live in chronic trauma. We can't just ignore the fact that there's an underlying racial tension underneath that needs to be addressed with a plan of reparations for slavery. And we can't just ignore the fact that we have a national defense agenda that has nothing to do with planning for peace 50 years ago, 50 years from now, but rather just puts corporate profits for huge military contractors before a path of genuine peace creation. We need to give the American people at least the option of choosing a vision which is more than just cosmetic change, but actually would move us into a different place.
Okay, well, on a number of the issues that you just talked about there, you are certainly speaking my language. But obviously, there's a lot of competition. There are many candidates running, and each of the candidates I've talked to, a couple, want this race to be about a certain number of different things. In terms of specific policies, if everything went your way, what are the specific issues that this primary would be decided on?
Number one, I would have a U.S. Department of Children and Youth. We have millions of American children who go to school every day in schools that don't even have the adequate school supplies to teach a child to read. And if a child cannot read by the age of 8, the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased and the chances of incarceration are drastically increased. We have simply normalized the despair of these children. This is a humanitarian crisis in our midst. We are collectively neglecting them. So that's number one, the U.S. Department of Children and Youth, in order to coordinate the information as well as the problem solving having to do with the extraordinary trauma and despair of these children. Number two, I want a plan of reparations. Germany has paid $89 billion to Jewish organizations since World War II, and I understand the moral force that is expressed when reparations are paid. This has gone far towards achieving reconciliation between Germany and the Jews of Europe, Germany and the rest of Europe. And a plan of reparations for slavery is long overdue in order to address an issue of economic restitution that has still not been made. And number three, we need to recognize that peace creation, we must wage peace as effectively as we prepare for war. War is the absence of peace. Peace is not the absence of war. We need not only a robust partnership between the State Department, expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, reducing violence against women, and ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever possible. That must be given equal weight to our efforts and appropriate efforts to make sure we're prepared for war. And we need a United States Department of Peace as well to address peace creation issues on a domestic level.
So let's dive a little bit deeper into that topic, because obviously, as of right now, we are involved in a number of different conflicts. We have been for a significant chunk of the entirety of my life. There are other conflicts that are potentially on the horizon. Donald Trump has been talking behind the scenes about wanting to possibly invade Venezuela. He's incredibly aggressive towards Iran. If you win 4 years from now, what will the situation look like in terms of American involvement in conflicts like Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and these other countries?
Well, first of all, the fact that we are giving aerial support to the Saudi Arabians, of course, the Senate is trying to change that now, stop that now. But it is the ultimate in whoredom. It is the ultimate in the desecration of American values that we were ever willing, for the sake of $100 billion in arms sale, go along with the Saudis, giving them aerial support without which they could not have been able to prosecute this war in Yemen. Tens of thousands of American of Yemenis have died, starved to death, including all those Yemeni children. This is an example of the whole point of my campaign. This is a moral rot underneath this political corruption. When Mike Pompeo said that we could have strategic partnerships with people who do not share our values, he was wrong about that. That means you have sacrificed your values. So I assure you, we would not be participating, conspiring, complicit in such criminal behavior as that war for the sake of any money, much less $100 billion in arms sales. However, the primary conversation that the political establishment is having is simply whether or not we should pull out of places where we are militarily involved now. The conversation has to be bigger than whether or not we pull out of certain military involvement. We still have to face the underlying issues of why we were involved in so many of these things to begin with. And that is the fact that our national defense agenda is based on advocacy for short-term corporate profits for military industrial contractors more than it is on a plan to create world peace. So if we just say, okay, we're going to get out of here, we're going to get out of there, we're going to get out of Afghanistan, we're going to get out of here, that in itself does not solve the problem. You have to cultivate health. You can't just decide what sickness to address. Large groups of desperate people should be seen as a national security risk. Desperate people do desperate things. Desperate people are more vulnerable to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces, whether in a corner of a city of the United States or in a corner of the world. So we need to do more than bring troops home. We need to bring love. We need to bring our values, not only of support for democracy, but for deep human compassion and care for people whose desperation can almost be predicted to lead them to desperate, dysfunctional, and even dangerous behavior for the rest of us. This is where America should be. We should be creating peace. We should be a moral leader in the world. And our candidates should be saying something more than, well, we'll bring the troops home from here or bring the troops home from there. We have to name the deeper problem.
Well, Marianne, you certainly have my interest. I think a lot of our audience is going to find much of what you said very interesting. I look forward to hearing you say in particular what you were talking about in terms of structurally why we end up in many of these conflicts on the debate stage, if you end up there. I wish that we had more time. Perhaps in the near future we can dive a little bit deeper into some of these issues.
I would like that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Ken Klippenstein with another report for TYT Investigates, some leaked chat messages from a secret group put together by Nancy Pelosi. More details on her position on impeachment after this. It's always a good day when we have a reason to bring on Ken Klippenstein of TYT Investigates here joining us now to talk about his recently released piece, which you can read on TYT.com, about Nancy Pelosi's Twitter group chats and what they have now revealed about her position on impeachment. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Not hearing Ken. We can get him. Maybe he might be trolling me. He is kind of a troll.
How's it going, better? Ken?
Good to have you back on. Tell me about your most recent story. So Nancy Pelosi recently, she has made pretty clear that she has no interest in pursuing impeachment. But we learned a little bit more thanks to some chat messages, correct?
Yeah, so she runs a number of Twitter group messages with volunteers. They're not paid as far as I know, but she relies on them to, you know, boost out her messaging. She sends out talking points, guidance on, you know, how to handle different kind of, you know, political situations. So I think they're important to being a kind of megaphone for her in social media.
And so recently, this group of influencers or whatever unbearable term is used for them, they were receiving a message from, I think it was Jorge and Nancy Pelosi's team or something like that about impeachment. And how did they characterize the reason that the speaker is not interested in pursuing impeachment of Donald Trump?
Well, what was interesting was people in these groups, which, you know, aren't doesn't seem to be publicly known. I couldn't find any reporting on it, reached out to me because they were upset about the way that she was handling the impeachment discussion. What's interesting is the folks that reached out to me, and more have reached out to me since the story was published, they weren't even necessarily, you know, really pro-impeachment. They just wanted to have a discussion about it and know, you know, where things stood. And so when the headlines came out last week, you know, where Pelosi was just like, quote, I'm not for impeachment. They're all like, wait, we never, you know, discussed this, or, you know, why isn't she for impeachment? They felt like she didn't give an adequate explanation for that. And then they were told, you know, if you don't agree with her, you can leave. And the people in the group were upset with that because, you know, they're not getting paid to do this. They're, you know, helping her for free. And they, you know, felt like the least that the Pelosi team could do was give them an explanation. And this wasn't some low-level staffer. This is her. This is her executive director of Pelosi for Congress and one of her spokespeople. So that was something they were upset about.
Okay. So what's interesting, though, also is you've done some research into the history of Nancy Pelosi and impeachment of different presidents. Should we really be surprised that she doesn't want to pursue it with Donald Trump?
I don't think so. This is almost uncanny how much of deja vu this feels like, because this is exactly not just what she did with the Bush administration, but almost to the same time frame. It was right after, I believe, they won the midterm elections in, I think it was 2006, that she almost immediately said, quote, impeachment is off the table. And, you know, the people, I have my own opinions on this, but the folks that I talked to, they were upset, not necessarily that they weren't pursuing impeachment. You know, they are adults and they understand that when the Republicans control the Senate, that makes it difficult. What they'd understand is, why would you immediately take it off the table? Why wouldn't you at least use it as a, you know, bargaining chip or a, you know, political tool? And also, we don't know everything that Mueller knows yet. So how can you say one way or the other, you know, if impeachment is something that can be pursued, if we don't even know what exactly Trump has done?
Yeah, and so, look, my next question, this, I guess, is kind of inference or something like that, but I'm trying to make sense of it. To the extent that we can ever know, honestly, why a politician is pursuing something, when they give us mixed messages, she has said that he's not worth it. I don't even really know what that means. In the chat messages, it looks like it's a, I don't want that a wedge to be driven in the Democratic Party, 2020 is too important. There's all these different messages. Based on your research across multiple different ways that she's messaged around this issue, do we have any idea of what the actual core argument against impeachment from her is?
No, it's very schizophrenic, and that's what people were upset about. You know, I want to stress again, these are, you know, very pragmatic individuals that reach out to me. These are not, you know, far-left individuals that want to split the party by any means. They want to have a coherent idea that they can understand and maybe not totally agree with, but say, okay, this is why they're doing it. They haven't been given that. She said she's been all across the board in the group. They, you know, tried to say what you said, we don't want to split the party. But then she's also said, you know, as the people that I've spoken to told me, you know, the party has drawn attention to these, you know, alleged high crimes. The word treason has been thrown around by a lot of people in the party. And, you know, I'm not commenting on that characterization either way. But when you do that, the base is going to, you know, want an explanation for you about, okay, so what are we going to do in a sort of law in order kind of justice kind of way? Like, how are they going to handle this? And then when you just say, oh, we don't want to cause, you know, internal dissension, that's not going to be an adequate explanation after everything people have seen and been told from the investigation. So she's been kind of across the board about, even if she opposes it, she said, I'm not for it. And then she said, well, actually, I'm just not for it now. And I asked our spokesperson, you know, what the conditions would have to be for her to be, for her to pursue impeachment if, you know, if any conditions exist, and they just never responded. So it's clear that they're not being forthright on this. And I think that is really the crux of the frustration.
So my final question, I know that you have to protect your sources and you won't actually reveal who it is that gave this to you. But I mean, I have to do some deduction, and it is obviously these are going to be resistance types, people with big followings online. Could you just like blink twice if it was a Krasenstein?
That's a good question. We'll have to see. That'd be quite the civil war. When you lose the Krasensteins, so goes the Krasenstein, so goes so much of the party, right? So I'm going to have to I'll have to check with them, but I'll let you know.
Okay, and if you're watching this and you don't know who we're referring to, just look at the replies.
No, you don't need to.
But if you went to literally anything that either Donald Trump or AOC has tweeted, they will have replied to it. So anyway, Ken, thank you as always for joining us. It's always good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, we're going to take one more break. I guess we have two. But after this break, we're going to be talking about the Green New Deal, the opioid epidemic. What is the link between the two? It's more interesting than you might think. Okay, so it's pretty obvious how the Green New Deal could help save lives from things like, obviously, you know, extreme weather events, overall heating, famine, things like that. But how would it actually save lives when it comes to America's addiction crisis? Joining us now to break down the possible link there is a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Abraham Gutman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here, and I have to say I really enjoyed your write-up about this issue. And I want to start by talking about sort of, I guess, the core argument that one side of the Green New Deal that's being ignored is that it could help to avoid what you term as deaths of despair. Could you explain that to our audience?
Yeah, so I think the core idea is, why do we have an addiction crisis? One maybe compelling, for sure, popular narrative is that the reason we have an addiction crisis right now is because of big pharma and reckless doctors that prescribe opioids that are extremely addictive. In reality, we see that the vast majority of people who get these medications don't get addicted, about 92%, and that these medications have been used, you know, throughout history. So the question is, why do we have this crisis now? And two researchers from Princeton, Ann Casey and Angus Deaton, have looked into that. And what they found is that there's a reduction in life expectancy and an increase in midlife mortality that is related to suicide, to overdose death, and to cirrhosis of the liver that is related to alcoholism. And what they coined is the term death of despair. They said that when life basically doesn't meet expectation, you look for relief. And so as a society that is becoming more unequal, that is becoming more unfair, structural racism persists. And when you don't see a future for the planet, it makes a lot of sense that there will be a lot of despair right now.
So that is fascinating. You talked about a couple of different factors there. How important is economic inequality to these hypothesized deaths?
So I think a lot. I mean, I don't think that we need too much science and, you know, complex hypothesis to make a really clear line. If your life is really hard, if you can't make ends meet, if you're suffering, if you can't provide for, you know, yourself, your people you love, and you turn and you find other solutions, then one of those solutions is drugs and alcohol, opioids, meth, crack, what have you. So I think that when you then see that others are living in this like super glamorous, lavish life, like, you know, the Capitol and the Hunger Games compared to your district, I can see that as something that drives a lot of despair and that makes you be very cynical and not want to participate in this game, essentially.
Okay, so that's interesting. So you've described the problem. So how would the Green New Deal function as a solution to that problem?
So I think that the beauty of the Green New Deal is that it finally is a policy that doesn't try to silo issues that aren't siloed, right? So we have a whole system, a whole structure that produces inequalities, that produces the fact that environmental hazards are more concentrated in areas that are black and brown, that we have a gender pay gap and a racial wealth gap. These are all connected. These are all issues that come together. So finally, we have a policy that tries to address those issues together and tries to view them as intertwined and trying to say that the role of the government is to solve this, which otherwise else, what is the role of the government? So if the problem is jobs and if we need to create more and we want to fight inequality, and we need to also fight climate change, let's use those jobs to give these jobs to people with stagnant wages or to communities of color that has been hurt by environmental hazard. Let's connect all these issues together. And I believe that by doing that, it provides a lot of hope to this despair.
So that's interesting that you talk about it being sort of inspirational or aspirational. And when I've listened to, especially AOC, but others talk about this policy, they often compare it to other massive challenges that we as a country have been able to meet and defeat. You know, things like, obviously, you know, some past wars, you know, helping deal with the hole in the ozone layer, acid rain, the space race, like things like that. Do you think that they get this connection, or what? Why do you think that's sort of one of the planks of how they're messaging around it, this message of inspiration?
Can I say something about inspiration as related to this? I think it's really important. A lot of people are shying away from the Green New Deal as an aspirational document. I think you heard, for example, I believe it was Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is kind of posing herself as a centrist in a Democratic race, that she's a co-sponsor of this document, not necessarily as policy, but as more of a aspiration. My excitement is on the Green New Deal as a list of policies that we should implement, not as something that in a different world we would do. Mm-hmm. So the aspiration is important, but people are not going to get out of addiction because, you know, AOC, introduced this resolution. The solution is what the policies are actually, if they will be enacted, right? So I think that's important. I do think AOC gets it. I think that she, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in the Green New Deal resolution, the first four pages are heartbreaking to read. They're a list of a lot of societal ailments, and they're not severed by some sections and some, you know, idea of like, let's first talk about climate, let's then talk about, like, no, they're intertwined, they're interwoven. The idea of voice is mentioned a lot. Let's include people in this process, people who are affected. And I think that's very, very powerful. And I think as a millennial that is seeing despair around her, maybe that's the push we needed. And perhaps as someone who is trying to think, you know, do I have a life on this planet 40, 50 years from now? Does my, you know, my one-year-old daughter? Maybe those are the moments that you go into despair, and those are the moments that someone with that view who thinks about that because it's real connects all the dots together.
Okay, well, that is fascinating. I mean, look, I'm going to be honest. I didn't need to be sold on it any more than I already was. But for some people who might have been sort of on the borderline, I think that your piece and the argument you're making could be very important. So Abraham Gutman, a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take one more break. This time, I'm being honest. And when we come back, news from around the world, some good, some tragic. It's the Damage Report after this. If you rely exclusively on American mainstream media, you may not know this, but there's stuff going on in other countries. And now we're going to take a look at it in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile in or on the moon, apparently we're going to be mining it in like 5 years or something, and the potential economic impact is massive. So the plan is to place a lander on the lunar surface to mine and process regolith for useful, that's the sort of compacted dust-like material that makes up most of the surface of the moon, for useful materials such as water, oxygen, metals, and an isotope called helium-3, which may prove useful for fueling future fusion reactors. Just really fast on that, I believe that's the same element that the movie Moon, that Sam Rockwell was in, that I didn't really like, but it was apparently everybody else liked it. Anyway, it's about mining that. Turns out, based in fact, and very valuable. We don't really have it here because of our atmosphere, but on the moon, it is something that exists. That is a dust-like material that covers the lunar surface, and they could use that as well, not just for mining, but also for compacting and forming something to live in on the moon. So why would we want to do this? Why go all the way there to get dust? Well, there's an estimated 1 million tons of helium-3 in the moon, though only about a quarter of that could be brought to Earth. But that by itself is enough to fuel the world's current energy demands for at least 2 or maybe as many as 5 centuries, according to one expert, who estimates that helium-3 is worth almost $5 billion a ton. I don't know that expert personally. They have experience in aerospace and all of that. But let's say that they're wrong by a lot. Doesn't really matter. That is pretty significant. And imagine what good could come from this. But anytime I talk about something like this, I like to talk about this stuff because I find it inspirational, so much so that I kind of want to write a book about it. But While this is awesome and will probably happen at some point, we cannot allow amazing future technologies like mining helium-3 or anything like it to dissuade us from taking action that is more concrete and actionable right now. So mining the moon is awesome, but doing something about fossil fuels today, even more awesome. And while that's going on, meanwhile in... meanwhile, in the air, some of it not quite as bright blue as that video we just showed you. The situation with air pollution is actually really bad, worse than we perhaps knew even recently. Deaths caused by air pollution appear to have overtaken those caused by smoking, according to a new study. In 2015, air pollution was thought to be responsible for 8.79 million deaths, compared with the 7.2 million caused by tobacco smoking. Now, that is in Europe, and obviously when you expand that over more of the world's surface, both in terms of people who are smoking, but also those who are inhaling that pollution, really bad. Now we find out an additional 790,000 deaths in Europe were likely caused by air pollution, with about 70 to 80% of those associated with cardiovascular disease. And for those who aren't dying from this immediately, they are still suffering from it. An average of about 2.2 years is being shaved off the life of an average European caused by poor air quality, with the situation being even worse in densely populated urban areas. So, look, this study focused on Europe, but there is every reason to believe that this is true in the US and Asia and Africa and all over the place. And think about that. If I said blank was causing 8 million deaths a year, is there anything other than air pollution I could put in that sentence that would not result in like headline news covering it constantly? Like if I said corgis were killing 8 million people a year, it'd be a big story. If it was Hot Pockets are killing 8 million people, which they might well be, we would talk about it a lot. But when it's air pollution, it's like, yeah, I guess people are getting cardiovascular disease somewhere else. But it's a big issue, and we should probably care about it. Another reason that doing something about climate change could have other effects, like getting pollution out of the air. It doesn't necessarily have to do with carbon in the atmosphere, but there's a lot of other bad stuff out there as well. Meanwhile, in... meanwhile, in Africa, and I don't want to be remotely flippant about this, multiple countries there are being devastated as a result of flooding caused by Cyclone Idai. It is absolutely terrible, the damage that it is wreaking. I was doing some research during the break, and apparently it has resulted in the formation of an inland ocean, a muddy body of water that did not previously exist there, that is 31 miles across. And it is flooding areas dozens and dozens and dozens of miles away from the ocean. That is how devastating it has been so far. It made landfall back on March 14th, the same day that the One Planet Summit started in Nairobi. After picking up speed with winds of 120 miles per hour, accompanied by lashing rains, Idai caused flooding and landslides, ruining crops and roads and already affecting literally millions of people. The cyclone has already claimed over 200 lives in Mozambique, 139 in Zimbabwe, 56 in Malawi, and these numbers are likely out of date. Mozambique recently said that 15,000 people are still stranded and need to be rescued, sometimes in very difficult to reach areas. And the president of Mozambique says that the death toll in that country alone might already be as high as 1,000. They just can't confirm it at this point. And by the way, the cyclone's path, 1.5 million people potentially affected by it. So again, look, I understand why we would be more, you know, attentive to extreme weather events that are affecting, you know, Texas or here in California. We've got the fires. But devastating extreme weather events are happening in other parts of the world as well, sometimes with even far higher death tolls, entire cities and towns being wiped out, entire croplands being destroyed, and we are still in the thick of it there. There are still, again, far over 10,000 people in individual countries that need to be rescued. One more piece of news, though. Meanwhile, in... meanwhile, in New Zealand, they are actually doing something about gun control after another massacre. They could perhaps teach us something here in the U.S. Here is the Prime Minister.
Today, I'm announcing that New Zealand will ban all military-style semi-automatic weapons. We will also ban all assault rifles. We will ban all high-capacity magazines. We will ban all parts with the ability to convert semi-automatic or any other type of firearm into a military-style semi-automatic weapon. We will ban parts that cause a firearm to generate semi-automatic, automatic, or close to automatic gunfire. In short, every semi-automatic weapon used in the terrorist attack on Friday will be banned in this country.
So that was Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern listing off changes that they're making. Any one of those changes is arguably more than we have done in this country after countless massacres, not necessarily always on the scale of the tragedy that New Zealand dealt with last week. But the death toll here, obviously, terrible as well. Hopefully we will learn from their example. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Twitter pointed out that Sandy Hook happened 6 years ago, and we can't even get a Senate vote on universal background checks. Not banning things, not, you know, taking things out of stores, just on checking to see who it is that is buying the sorts of weapons that terrorists so often choose to use. So hopefully in America, we will take this as inspiration and follow in their wake. Anyway, thank you everybody for watching this episode of The Damage Report. We've got one more show. Brett Ehrlich is going to be here tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.